My name's James Bridle. I'm a writer and artist. I was originally from London and lived there for the first 35 years of my life. My parents both also English and come from various bits of kind of southern England for a few generations. Now, a few years ago I moved to Greece, first to Athens, and now for the last couple of years on a small island in the Saronic Gulf close to Athens. Which is where we are today. It's a really beautiful day.
It was a long trip to this magic island amid the Aegean Sea. I had set the sails to meet James Bridle, one of the greatest thinkers of our times. Their books are full of revelations, but every argument asks for a new thought. And every question generates a thousand more. Such a marvelous encounter, such a magic moment. I am Markus Zohner, and this is Monte Verita, Borderlines.
What will happen once we as a society, and I as an individual, cross the border we are standing on? The world is an edge. Climate catastrophe, war in the heart of Europe, dangerous tensions in the Western Pacific, and a pandemic. It is ever more difficult for every single human being and society to adapt to the threats and find ways out. There will be no return to normal as we knew it in the foreseeable future. Monte Verita Borderlines is a podcast about literature, art and science produced by Eventi Letterari Monte Verita and Markus Zohner Arts Company. Through encounters with writers and intellectuals, we will look back to grasp what has been lost and understand the world we're living. We'll look ahead. We'll try to sketch new ideas. Imagine utopia in the spirit of the Monte Verita and look at emerging social and artistic landscapes. Join us in exploring the new world arising in front of our eyes.
We are all trying to understand the world. We are trying to understand connections, reasons for things. We are trying to understand scientific discoveries, medical procedures, politics, evolving culture, and the people around us. We are more or less desperately trying to give sense to things, to make sense out of what is around us, to understand. In Ways of Being, you write, in the process of making meaning, the more than human world is complicit and essential. Why would you say this? Why can't we do it by ourselves? Why do we need the more than human world for that?
Meaning is not something that belongs only to humans. Meaning is a quality of the whole world. And we're not alone in the world. Okay. We're surrounded by all these other beings, and we're in constant communion with them. Yes. The very idea that we exist alone, that we can exist alone, is ridiculous. Yes. Like, we can't exist alone physically.
Yes.
Like, a human can't live in a vacuum.
Yes. Yes.
Humans can't live without other humans. We can't live without other organisms. We can't live without the air we breathe, without the microorganisms in our body, with the food that we eat. We're constantly partaking of the world. And our consciousness, our intellectual life, our ideas are part of that same ecology. So there's no meaningfulness to the world that isn't of the world itself, and that goes beyond the human.
Okay, this is wonderful, because people would certainly agree we can't live in an isolated way, as you say. But the question of meaning is something we often take as purely human, not giving meaning, trying to understand things. Do you think animals, bacteria, more than human world is giving meaning to the world or trying to understand something?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on what you mean by meaning. Because meaning, as I think you're describing it, is quite a human conception of the world. Mm-hmm. And of course we can have ideas that belong to us, that are part of our particular being in the world, because we are incarnated, we're embodied in this particular way for this particular period of time. And so we experience the world, you know, uniquely, not specially, not, you know, hierarchically above anything else, but uniquely from our own perspective. And so, of course, we'll bring to it our own particular
perspective that creates its own forms of meaning. We conceptualize that as a meaning because of our kind of embodiment. Mm. So I don't know if it makes any sense to ask if other beings consider the world to have a kind of meaning, but do they experience it? Do they have their own individuality and their own unique perspective on it? And do they in fact have some way of expressing that? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I fundamentally believe that capacity for individual experience and expression of that experience, however you conceptualize it, whether you conceptualize it as meaning or consciousness, and these words can have all these different, slightly different meanings, then I think that is the universal.
Mm. Okay. Okay. What would you consider? How would you call it? The what is the more than human world?
So the more than human. If you're not familiar with the term, this term more than human was coined by the philosopher David Abraham, who's written some really wonderful books, and thinks a lot about kind of ecological questions and our relationships with other beings. And he coined this term more than human to express something sort of quite specific but very powerful, which is that we want to de-emphasize the importance of the human while keeping both our relationship to the world around us and emphasizing, as I mentioned before, human uniqueness without this kind of specialness. And so the problem is if you use terms like non-human, which a lot of people do, or if you just say animals, plants, microorganisms, or you try and encapsulate that in something like the non-human, it still has this like antithetical relationship to the non-human. Yeah. Negative, but also creating a kind of space or barrier between them. Even when we use words like the environment or nature, we're creating this space between us, implying that there is some kind of figure and ground, and some kind of, place that the human can stand separate from everything that surrounds us. And so Abraham used this term more than human to emphasize the fact that humans have their own unique space within this wider community, but we are part of something much, much larger. We're not in no way disconnected from it. And to keep this very careful balance, I think, between not privileging the human while constantly acknowledging that we can't escape being human, that we are ultimately anthropos, and so we always have this anthropocentric view to some extent, which we have to remain conscious of while not allowing it to completely kind of subsume our understanding of the world.
It's very essential, this insisting on this expression, because this is what you do. Now you really continuously name it, and this is really, really, I think, really important to being kind of humble, but in the same way, not, as you say, not denying we are humans.
Yeah.
We need to do both, no?
Yeah, absolutely.
Very, very important, very nice. How could the complicity between the more than human world and the human world be? What could this complicity look like?
I mean, that's a huge question. Takes way forward. I mean, we are complicit already.
Sometimes and sometimes not.
Well, by complicit, you mean like consciously?
Yes. Understanding this problem, the relation, and what could be our steps towards this world?
I mean, there's various steps. I think there's a change in consciousness, and then there's a change in kind of practice and politics. And the change in consciousness requires us to acknowledge that all other beings are kind of alive, aware, intelligent, are living, are being in ways that we can relate to, which is already like a huge step for us. It's something that, we haven't, we kind of banished from our consciousness millennia ago. This is a process I find myself still very much trying to understand. But I do believe it cannot have always been this way. Mm-hmm. We have kind of been trained out of this awareness, which means it's something that we can recapture, and also something that many humans haven't lost in the same way. And so, we can bring ourselves into greater awareness of this kind of more than human communion, which we're always a part of. And we're just really, really well trained at ignoring. But beyond that, we can make some definite steps, and kind of interesting things can happen in that regard. So yeah, I do think that that kind of revolution in consciousness is the most important part and is absolutely essential, like for anything further to happen, but also like for our mutual survival. What you then do with it, there's kind of, you know, lots of interesting answers to that. You can see what happens in the sciences, for example, when people take non-human collaborators seriously. We could talk about stories like that. You know, we get to understand the world differently. One thing I didn't say earlier when we were talking about this question of meaning, it's worth pointing out that historical and many contemporary kind of ideas of human meaning aren't just wrong, they're like actively destructive. So if you look at the way in which science makes meaning, scientific meaning often destroys its subject. The forms of kind of categorization, indexing, all the way through to kind of dissection, vivisection, this kind of splitting apart of things, that's not the world. Like, it doesn't, it's not a description of the world, it's a description of death that it makes. So that those forms of meaning that humans often center on don't represent the world. So they create their own separation. But other ways are possible. And none of this is to deny the usefulness of the scientific method under certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. But when it is done without collaboration, complicity of the more than human world, like a great deal is lost. And I think also, you know, another area that I'm particularly interested in is more than human politics.
Okay.
What it would mean to actually involve the voices, the intentions, the desires, the needs, the beinghood of more than humans into and with a human politics. Like, how does that come about? How does that change our behavior, the ways we build governance systems, and ultimately the way we, you know, live?
But this is more than animals' rights or something. You're going much further, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely further than animal rights. It's the rights of all living beings, the rights of the earth itself, the rights of ecosystems.
Environment.
And also probably beyond rights. I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that rights really aren't the basis
for this. Because rights are always conceded in a way, but it should be much, much more active, shouldn't it?
Absolutely. Rights are always something that is kind of granted by a governing power.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result can always be taken away.
Exactly.
And that's really not a good basis for the kind of politics that we need. Mm-hmm. And that's being voiced very well just within human politics already. There's plenty of arguments for that. And that really needs to continue into the more than human world.
Okay. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. But we are very much human-centered. I mean, it's very difficult. It's very difficult because it seems as if human empathy stops where the more than human world starts.
It stops a long way before that. I mean, I think that's I think it's very important, because I've argued kind of around empathy for a long time as a really bad way of thinking about the world and a bad way of acting in the world. Not bad, but like not a terribly helpful one. Like our empathy barely extends beyond the end of our own street, really, beyond our kind of family and close kin, you know, and our close friends. And, you know, sometimes up to maybe our city or our nation, but very tenuously and in very difficult and complex ways. It definitely does not extend to the whole of our species.
No.
I almost no humans without, like, who aren't very, very good and trying very, very hard have empathy for our entire species. So the idea that empathy could extend. But that tells us something really important about empathy, which is that empathy requires a common experience to function. Like, we like to think that we can imagine someone else's lives, but actually it's a very almost like aggressive maneuver to have empathy, because you're reducing another being to what you can understand
about
them. What is
your conception or your perceiving of the world.
Yeah. And that's the only way one can kind of enter into a kind of empathetic, a true empathetic relationship. Of course, you can have pity and care and all these kinds of things, but real empathy requires that, and it fails so easily. With really terrible consequences if you're basing everything on empathy. You know, so yeah, I think it's really worth looking beyond that to other ways one can care and think that
and
don't require
what,
this kind
what
of...
What could be these... I mean, it's very interesting for myself, because, of course, coming from theatre, I'm a trained actor and then director and everything. There very much is based on empathy, isn't it? I mean, you have Hamlet doing all the stuff and killing, and you as a public go into him. It's all going through empathy, isn't it? I mean, it's very much working on this. He's doing that for you, and you can follow his feelings and his deeds and everything, because there's kind of connection, human connection you project into him, which is empathy in the end. So theater, and I think much of this kind of arts, performing arts, or even cinema and all these, is based on empathy, isn't it? So what would be the next step you're talking about, which is very important? I mean, it's really basic what you're saying. What is the next step? Because as you say, empathy is very limited. I mean, I can have it to the very few people around me, and then it already becomes hard. Mm. And it's a, as you say, it's a form of aggression, but it's also a form of, I need to invest very much power into it to be able to extend it beyond my child or my wife or my husband or whatever. Mm. What could be the next step? What is this possibility?
Well, I mean, politically, which a lot of this comes down to, really, is the term that I use more often, though, is solidarity, which is a political term for being able to, you know, give rights and power to others, regardless of your, like, personal feeling towards them. You just simply say, like, you have the right to life. I may not know you. I may never know you, critically. But, you know, I still believe in your rights. It's so hard to get away from that terminology. To kind of life and survival and flourishing and everything else. And at the, but on the emotional level, I think there's other capacities as well. Like, you know, we can appreciate things, the value, the power of things without, the word that actually comes to mind is awe. Like if you're watching a storm, a huge kind of thunderstorm rolling across the horizon, that's the image that comes to mind. I don't have empathy for that. I have awe, you know, I have wonder, which generates in me a huge feeling of value for this thing, both for my own experience and for the thing that is happening in front of me. It's not the only way to, empathy is not the only way to engage emotionally with the world either. We have a much sort of greater range that doesn't require this kind of dominating form of knowing. Which is so destructive.
Mm-hmm. Your fantastic book, New Dark Age, also exists as an audiobook.
Yes.
One of my collaborators told me he tried to listen to the book, but found it extremely hard to understand, listening to it. His English is excellent. In the end, he chose to read it with his eyes. I was curious about his reasons. I listened to a sample and immediately thought that this edition of New Dark Age in this version was read by a machine.
Of how things work. It must be extended to how things came to be and how they continue to function in the world in ways that are often invisible and interwoven. What is required is not understanding, but literacy. True literacy in systems consists of much more than simple understanding and might be understood and practiced in multiple ways. It goes beyond a system's functional use to comprehend its context and consequences. It refuses to see
the application. An AI text-to-speech engine translates your written text into audio. It was impossible for me to listen for longer than 2 minutes. I quickly lost the thread. I had no chance of following or understanding. So the text is yours. I understand it when I read it with my eyes. Why don't I understand when I'm listening to the same words read by a machine?
Okay, well, first of all, I apologize. I had nothing to do with the production of that audiobook, and I'm very unhappy about it. As far as I'm aware, it's read by a real human being who's just somewhat machine-like in their diction, and I've been told by many people it's very hard to read, hard to listen to. So, yeah, again, I apologize for that. I read the next audiobook, and I hope people seem to enjoy it more. But you do raise a really sort of nice, interesting question. That all of this is just forms of communication. It's just forms of transmission. And actually what it makes me think about is an experience that I wrote about in the next book, Ways of Being, about my encounter with Karen Barad, a kind of quantum physicist and feminist theorist. Karen Barad is, one of the, few thousand people on this planet who actually understand quantum physics. But critically, much smaller number is capable of explaining it, of talking about it to a lay audience. And I was lucky enough a few years ago to hear her speak as part of a larger exegesis around, what we should learn and understand and relate to one another as a result of quantum theory. She explained certain aspects of quantum theory that I had not previously understood. And while she was explaining them, I, and I think a lot of other members of the audience, understood quantum physics, right? Like, she's a poet. And while she was speaking, this kind of understanding hung in the auditorium above us. And we were all part of the same process, very theatrical moment, like the kind of shared experience of something. You know, and the moment she stopped speaking, or the moment we all filed out of that auditorium, yeah, it imploded. Sort of went. Like, I understood something that I hadn't understood before, but if you asked me now to explain some of the things that she explained to us, I wouldn't be able to do so. Because, you know, communication is not a one-way thing. It's not a fixed thing. It's not an internal process. It's a relational process. Just as the kind of audiobook experience you're describing was, you know, when one writes, I mean, you can write forever in little notebooks for yourself or never read them again, but something else happens when that writing goes out into the world and meets another mind and is kind of reanimated. And, you know, most of us quite like the voice in our own heads when we're reading. It seems like a lot of people, I'm not very good at audiobooks actually, but a lot of people seem to almost prefer them.
Of course.
You know, and like to be read to in these ways. And when those sync up, the ideas and the performance of them, then it works. But I mean, even when you're reading a text to yourself, you are performing that text to some extent.
Exactly.
And I presume there's people who are bad at that too.
Yeah.
But the real point here, as I say, is that these things are relational. And they're a result of these meetings of speakers and listeners, of texts and the kind of mental reanimation of those texts, of minds. And they have no meaning outside that interaction.
I completely agree. What I was interested in was the point of understanding, because once, as you told about the quantum physics, there is kind of phenomenon there. If the person reading the text is understanding what he or she reads, the public has a chance to understand it. And maybe in this other audiobook, which seems machine read, maybe is, maybe not, I didn't really analyze it. But one thing is sure, that if it was a person, she doesn't understand a word. So this kind of understanding of the intermediate person reading it seems to be crucial.
And it makes me think of like listening to a preacher who doesn't actually believe in their own words.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then I was coming to the question, if it was an AI, well, just let's say it was, the AI would not really understand the content in this case. Do you think there could be a next step where the AI fakes it so good that it could work?
Oh, this is happening right now. I mean, the latest, like, so-called AIs, because, you know, we can get deep into that if you want. But these large language models that are being put into play right now by kind of Microsoft and Google and everyone else, you know, they're very, very powerful knowledge engines, and they absolutely do not understand what they're saying. They have no understanding in that sense. And that's a direct factor in the fact that what they often produce is nonsense. It has this deeply disturbing quality of feeling like meaningful nonsense, as in it reads like it makes sense, but it actually doesn't. But that's because they're essentially dreaming it. They're regurgitating a memory of the world. It's a very odd process. They've just read lots and lots of books, and they know how language is supposed to work, and they're just repeating that language according to things that they've read before, but it has no relationship to the world itself. It has no truth to it. I see no reason why they shouldn't in the future, though. There doesn't seem to me to be any reason why, like, we wouldn't be able to develop the kind of frameworks and mechanisms for understanding, in big scare quotes, artificially. Yeah, we haven't done it yet, but machines do understand all kinds of things. They in the sense of a, this is a tricky one to explain. What am I trying to explain here? In every way that a machine actually functions, it embodies an understanding of the world in which it is functioning. All the technology around us is functioning because it's working on an embodied understanding of the flow of electrons, for example. Like, that is an embodied understanding in those things that has been made kind of manifest by them. And so they're operating based on that understanding all the time. That they can understand in the same way more complex things and therefore be able to produce this kind of truthfulness about them. Because what they're doing right now is producing the truthfulness of electrons. They're producing the truthfulness of plastics and metals, right? So they can produce truthfulness about other things as well, if we could figure out the kind of the configuration in which to put them. We haven't done yet, but I don't see any reason why we shouldn't. Mm-hmm. Or why, in fact, they shouldn't themselves. Because I think there's, you know, factors will come together outside of, like, full human intentionality to make that happen as well, mm-hmm. as it always has.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you very much. There's this point that machines will be, I say machine systems, call it how you want, will be always more trained to understand the human being and to give the human being the feeling that he or she is understood.
Mm.
So being able to analyze the mood from a face, for example, mm-hmm. and a machine, whatever it is shaped like, will say, Marcus, tonight you look very sad, is very simple to do already, yeah. and it will be always more simple. So what happens there is that machines will be able to touch our feelings and to make us open up in a non-controlled way, let's say, because until now, these machines I've got around me, I clearly can see them as instruments.
Mm.
The computer in front, I'm writing, it's one directional. It does some tasks for me, I will do that. The recorder, the microphones, I can see them clearly as a world outside of me. But once I walk into a room and some kind of machine said, oh, Marcus, tonight you seem very, very sad. Did you sleep well? It will touch me somewhere, and it will make me answer things which I today would never answer to a machine. How do you see this interface? It will improve always more, I guess, because there's some kind of trick to get into the human soul. Have you heard of this app called Replica? It is a horrible chatbot. You can pay $10 per month or something, and it will ask you these. It's just a chatbot till now, and you have figures, and it's designed. I can show it to you. It's very, very, very bad, because it really starts to get into you, and it really starts to ask you questions. And on these questions, it's learning about you. And even if you say, if you answer odd things, why didn't you sleep well? Well, I had too much sex or something. It will anyhow take it and come back to you with it, and it will continue touching you. And this is some, how to say, this is one of the dangers I saw, where really a kind of abyss opened up, which I don't see so much in ChatGPT or something, because you can see the systems, but there they somehow go into you, and they manipulate something which you can't control anymore.
So, I mean, first of all, that was the first trick that AI learned. Mm. Like, one of the most famous like, experiments in AI history is the chatbot Eliza, which I'm sure you're familiar with. You know, who back in the 1960s,
yes.
Like, was programmed to replicate a Rogerian psychoanalyst who, you know, by asking a series of questions, and it was the simplest thing in the world, because it just basically kept asking, like, how do you feel? Why do you feel that way? Basically repeating.
And what does it have to do with your mother or something?
Yeah. No, not even that. Like, literally just Rogerian psychoanalysis just kind of repeats the question back. Says, how do you feel? I feel sad. Why do you feel sad? Yeah. I feel sad because of this. Why does it make you feel that way? This constant prompting, very easy to code. And it was coded, and it was incredibly successful, and people thought it was an AI. Famously, possibly apocryphally and definitely highly gendered, the creator's secretary was using it and like asked him to leave the room so she could be in private with this conversation. And so it was immediately kind of incredibly convincing. First world candidate for passing the kind of Turing test, which has always been this long, complex question about what extent machines resemble us or fool us. And I know your question does seem to be based a lot on that fear, which is totally valid, but is also totally separable from the question of AI. Because, like, if someone decides to build an AI tool to psychologically damage you, they probably can quite successfully. But, you know, but that has nothing to do with AI and everything to do with someone's intent to psychologically damage you. And you can see the same, very similar processes happening in all kinds of technological interfaces that aren't based on AI. You know, I think about things like GPS systems that guide people in particular ways. I think about algorithmic recommendation systems online that, like, basically get people to watch things or buy things that they had no conscious intention of doing so. We are very easy to manipulate with technology, and it really has nothing to do with intelligence on either side, because it can be done by incredibly stupid computers to very intelligent people and vice versa, and it really has nothing to do with that. So the manipulation possibilities are huge and incredibly dangerous. And you know, that's why this conversation has to go into questions of capitalism and power and all these kind of things and who runs these things. But the other thing I was just thinking while you were saying that is that all peak human experiences of consciousness have also always involved these kind of like moments of mind alteringness and opening up. And the idea that a simulated agent of some kind would be able to place us into a state of vulnerability and, malleability. Well, if that's not done with the intention of having power over
exploiting
you, of exploitation, then, you know, what else could it be done for? Like, that seems to me like a... Again, if we're capable of separating this question of power and exploitation from the technology itself, which I'm not sure we are, but if we are, then, you know, then that seems to me like an interesting possibility. Yeah.
If I ask Siri, hey Siri, she would say, uh-huh.
Yeah, guys, she's here. She's in the room with us.
But, I have a female voice there, yeah. And she would say, uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it's... giving me kind of kick, which is different.
We know a lot about the human brain.
Yeah.
And we figured out a lot of the tricks to access it a long time ago. And these technologies are very close to the body now.
Exactly.
Most of them are like accessing like parts of our brain that are below conscious processing most of the time.
Exactly. Mm.
And yeah, that's a huge danger. And it's a good reason to keep those sort of technologies at a very serious
out of the room,
while they are entirely constructed by entities which do not have your best interests at heart.
Of course, of course. My watch knows more about my sleep than I do. I mean, incredible.
But only because you wear the watch.
Of course.
If you take the watch off, you'll know more.
Yeah.
And you'll probably, you know, pay more attention to it as well. Yeah. Because you've, you know, as soon as you admit that into your life, you stop paying attention to that thing in the same way.
Outsourcing.
And that's true of all our things. The more kind of screens of all kinds that we put between ourselves and the environment, the less we actually directly perceive it. Mm-hmm. But that's recoverable.
Language is relational. In Ways of Being, you say something very important. Language, like intelligence, is something relational. The fact that language is relational is quite clear. Without relation, probably there would be no need for language. But why is intelligence relational? How did you arrive to this conclusion?
When I set out to write Ways of Being, I thought it would be a book about intelligence, because that was my kind of way in to some of the larger questions that I wanted to ask. And I kind of naively thought there'd be like a good solid definition of intelligence out there in the literature that I could work with. And I realized very quickly that wasn't the case. That when people talk about intelligence, when writers write about it, or when we just talk about it in public, we either explicitly or just in our heads basically have like a list, a kind of grab bag of different qualities that may or may not be part of the thing we're talking about. So that's things like problem solving and planning and tool use and more complex things like theory of mind and self-awareness, a whole bunch of different
creating
things. Yeah, creativity, though, you, exactly, like depending on the conversation you have, these different kind of qualities within it kind of come and go, though generally and historically what, you know, the box in which they've all been put together is like what humans do. That is that's the implicit definition of any kind of intelligence conversation that most of us have most of the time. And so when you start to understand the ways in which that doesn't fit anymore, when you start to look at the types of intelligence that are quite obviously displayed by non-humans in all kinds of different ways, things that are unarguably intelligent but don't fit into this definition necessarily of what humans do, then you have to kind of start expanding that. And the first thing that happens is I began to understand intelligence as something embodied. That's kind of the first thing. That intelligence is not something that just happens in the head. It's something that is the kind of product and outcome and process of being in a particular type of body. So humans have the kind of intelligence that we have because of the kind of bodies that we have.
And the machines have the kind of intelligence because of their kind of body.
Body and like experience, mm-hmm. you know, and environment as well. Because it's like, well, how does your body then interface with your environment? So therefore, what kind of structures does the brain grow, you know, in deep time? Or what kind of adaptations do you make in the present to be able to respond with the body that you have to the environment around you? So you know, your intelligence, one's intelligence, whether one is a human or a seal or a, you know, fern, depends on all of those things, on your senses, on your body plan, on what you touch, and what touches you. And that second bit, of course, immediately takes you beyond the body. You say, well, what touches you and what do you touch? Well, that's not just you anymore. In fact, there is no you. There is no such thing as the individual. We can speak to that biologically now, but we've spoken to it kind of spiritually and psychically for millennia. There is no individual, and so there can be no intelligence of the individual. There can only be an intelligence that arises out of our relationships with everything else. One of the people I think has always, you know, for me expressed this the best is the cybernetician Gregory Bateson. You know, he had this whole concept of the what he called the kind of eco-mental model. That the you know, he thought that the greatest sin of the kind of 19th, 20th century science was to regard the individual as what he called the universe, or what Darwin really called the unit of survival, was this kind of individual thing. And our belief that the individual is the unit of survival has led to this kind of fallacy of individualism, but also of kind of human centrism and speciesism, where we disregard the rest of the environment and we just dump stuff out into it. You know, and his example, he always used Lake Erie, which in the kind of 1960s and 1970s was particularly badly polluted. And he described Lake Erie as being driven mad by this. And as a result, human society was driven mad because we're totally interlinked. Because the lines which connect us, the lines which make meaning, are not the borders of the individual, but are the relationships across the borders between individuals and their environment. That's the relationality that occurs. Intelligence only matters, only has any meaning when it matters, by which I mean when it comes into being, when it is enacted by our relationships with other things.
When it happens.
When it happens. It's an active motive process. One can't be intelligent as an individual. It doesn't have any meaning at this point. Because even if you think you're just a brain in the jar, like there's nothing to think unless there's something to think other than oneself. There is no thought in a vacuum. Everything is the product of relationships.
This is wonderful, James, because it's really wonderful because, and nobody says that. It's really, I mean, I don't want to say it's a new thought, but it is, and it's so basic. It's so basic. It's so important to understand this and to state it and to put it into action. And to teach it. I mean, this is really a very, very, very important point. Because it's clear we don't exist without others. Of course, we are dependent, as you said, completely. But that this concerns especially intelligence, or what we call intelligence, is extremely important. It's basic, really.
It's like, I am not, a philosopher in the sense that I have very little knowledge of reading in like philosophy and research, some of the things I said. But the thinker that I come into contact the most from the perspective mostly of animal rights is Descartes. Who really did some of the most extreme damage to human relationships, to the more than human world, by believing that everything that was not human was essentially a kind of mechanism. He thought that nothing else felt pain. He, popularized vivisection, really horrific practices, because he just thought everything else was a kind of dumb machine. And his central tenet was like, I think, therefore I am. As though thinking was possible without being. Yeah. Which is that the entire thing is backwards, and that is the foundation of the last 300 years of European thinking and everywhere that it's taken it. And that feels like a kind of virus. I actually quite like viruses, so I shouldn't be rude about them, but like something bad that got into our thinking several hundred years ago, and is connected obviously to a whole bunch of other trouble in our civilization, but when you see it from the other way around, when that ecological moment happens in the mind, it really kind of blows everything else away.
In the end, it's all down to humility and to understand that we are just not the center, and our human intelligence is just not the center of nothing. I mean, it's just a virus on some planet lost somewhere in the nothing. I mean, it's.
But it's hard to do, and it has to fight with a whole bunch of kind of fear and uncertainty in doing so. Mm. Like it's frightening to people.
To people,
in a lot of ways, to acknowledge,
give away some certainty, because there's some
belief
certain.
That one is giving something away.
Exactly,
make the argument one is gaining everything.
Yeah.
But. When you are raised within a society and a civilization that values individualism, doesn't just value it, says it is the most important thing, and that to be a sovereign individual, with all the cascading things that come out of that, that then define you of style and property rights and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, when that is the totality of your identity, it's terrifying existentially. To give it away, collapse.
To let it go.
So it's a hard process, but
it's a hard process, and I think it's a hard process for society, which in reality very much lives on the opposite. I mean, as long as money earning is a value, you have a problem, because this is all feeding your ego, all feeding this kind of thing. It's all about this egocentrism in a way, and all the society is feeding that. And I mean, changing that will be a huge progress. I mean, but maybe it's the only way. I mean, it will be.
It really must be the only way. Yeah, yeah. There's no way for us to come.
Maybe your next book should be The Only Way.
It's just something that I'm still. Always in a process of coming to understand, but there's no way for us to come into a relationship, better relationships with the earth in ways that allow us to survive on the earth and on an earth that isn't so horrifically changed that we really don't want to see it, without this like quite radical change in consciousness that stops seeing the world as in any way separate from us and in any form of superiority that we have. I mean, I was listening to someone talk the other day and they made a really good point that there's fundamentally no difference between the way that matters between the way, an environmentalist sees, a field or a lake and that an oil baron does, because they both think they have power over it. When one says, and I'm talking meanly about the environmentalist, the oil baron can go to hell, but like one says, oh, we shall use this for the extraction, and the other one says, no, we shall save this and we shall preserve it. And both of those are expressions of human power and agency over the rest of the world. And while we still think like that, which I don't know if we cannot, I don't know if I can't, then we'll continue to behave in exactly the way that we have done.
There's a kind of fascism in that, isn't that? It's in the end, it's a kind of fascistic thing. Supremacy.
Yeah, I mean, to speak, to even to speak without enacting these kind of modes of power and domination is really, really, really hard.
Well, these are huge things to understand and then to change. I mean, how to tell that to the guy who's driving his Porsche?
Yeah, I'm still driving a, you know, fossil fuel driven car around. Like, I'm not. Yeah. None of us are clean in this.
No, we are not. We're working towards it. I had to come by plane this time, and
we can enact it in ourselves.
Yeah, we do.
And we can, you know, we really can, and we can start to enact it in our communities.
Yeah.
And that really does matter. You know, for myself, I try very badly, very poorly, very weakly, to enact it for myself, and mostly to learn. Mostly to learn, more learning than doing. Don't, you know, and then the teaching. You know, and then sharing that with small groups. And then at the same time working on these, you know, these bigger questions of what does this look like enacted at scale? You know, because I find I'm fascinated by both the, you know, the individual modes that allow me to learn and understand and practice these ideas more. And I like genuinely, like, what would this look like at a planetary scale? Like, how would we get from where we are now to where we need to be? And those are big, difficult questions. But, you know, but we have systems of governance. We are capable of governing ourselves. Mm. These are long time-long processes.
It is that as if some part of us is still living in the Middle Ages, and there's a glimpse of a future somewhere, a glimpse of a light somewhere, but it's a hard way out there, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, the other function is there is an enemy. Which is that there are powerful forces who don't want this to happen, and that also needs to be part of our kind of calculus in this. Let's quote Ursula Le Guin for what it will. It's rarely the first time, yeah. But you know, while living under the divine right of kings, it was impossible to imagine a different way of being, and the same could be said of capitalism now. But everything changes in time, and there's plenty of alternative systems available to us, and. While we live, like, change is possible, and change is the constant. It's the Octavia Butler as well, to bring in another person at the table. You know, change is God in Butler's conception, which I love, not only for its, you know, centering of change and reminding us that change is, like, not just possible but happening all the time, but also that, you know, it's another form of relationality. It's another kind of insistence that we are, like, midway in a process. Because change itself is this process of moving from one state to another. And so for that itself to be God, right, for that movement itself to be God, is such a statement about the true nature of reality, which is a reality of relationships. Of what Karen Barad calls interactions, of everything becoming because of its movement, not because of its, like, stasis or individuality.
Or because we want something, but it's independent from us. I mean, it's just the change in itself is a value, is the point.
It's not that it's the point. There's no value. There's no point. meaning in that sense. It just is. It is the world. The world emerging. The world becoming. Mm. And you know, we're all part of that becoming. Mm. And it will go where it will go. But we know for our brief time here, we have a we're involved in that. We're engaged. We're committed.
And we have kind of power. I mean, we have.
Monte Verità, Borderlines.
Technology and power. The telegraph allowed for the rapid transmission of ideas and information, but was quickly suborned by financiers, media moguls, and the military to leverage inequalities of information into inequalities of power and profit. As you say, similar historical processes are at work on the internet today. What is going on? Is the first question, and then I have second and third.
Okay, that's a lovely thing that I wrote. Sounds nice. Thanks for reading it. It implies somehow that the technology sort of magically emerged and then was taken over, at least in the text of the Telegraph, which is also not the case. Like, you know, these things have always been bound together so tightly. But, you know, what's happening with the internet is pretty simple in that it is the dream of the internet. held by some, and certainly held as a kind of article of faith by a lot of the early architects, was that it would be a truly decentralized network. Meaning that no part of the network would have more power than any other. And that really hasn't happened. The way that the physical architecture of the internet has evolved is incredibly centralized. It's nationally centralized. You know, some countries are more powerful than others on the internet. The ways in which like national networks are interconnected are these kind of channels of power. So you see the way in which, like, very obviously, like, historically imperial power continues in network infrastructure, for example, in the connection of kind of West African former British colonies back to the UK or South America to Spain. You still see these colonial relationships in the network. And then you have the power of, you know, quite a small number of corporations that centralize all this power around them. So people like, you know, Google and Facebook and Amazon are these kind of very, very powerful nodes within the network. And huge amounts of the network's traffic flows through them. And that means money and power, and those two things being really tightly linked. And it keeps happening to almost everything. You know, we've video calling, which is one of these technologies that I'm always fascinated by, that goes from being complete science fiction, right? Dick Tracy watches the whole deal, to like incredibly boring and annoying, like really quickly. Like, video calling is a thing that we've been obsessed with as a society, as like proper science fiction for ages, and now it's here. God, is it dull. And it's basically all one company. Like, there's a few, but there's mostly Zoom. And there was mostly Skype before that, and there's a few others. But all of them are centralized, right? None of them are internet-based. Their infrastructure is exactly like the old telephone companies, as in there's a few central switching points that we all dial into, and all of the information passes through that point and then goes out to one else. That is not what the internet is supposed to look like. The internet should be direct or like indirect, but multiple connections between multiple nodes. And you can see within that for all of those early internet pioneers, or for some of them, and for a lot of us using it in the early days, that was an embodiment of, like, embodiment and demonstration and means to make that kind of dream of mutual empowerment real. Like, decentralization of information would literally produce decentralization of power. And in fact, the opposite has occurred. We have centralization of information, centralization of power, and the network that we built has become a totalizing force for that. That was a deliberate act in multiple ways involving governments and corporations to like capture the power of this emergent technology in exactly the way previous, you know, communications technologies have been captured. And it's a huge, huge part of that as well that really bears repeating, is that it also, again, has nothing to do with technology and everything to do with power, and particularly with education. The way in which the network was constructed in such a way that those corporations could capture it as it grew, keep it within their kind of power.
Real.
But alongside that is the failure to educate people, which is also a kind of power act by governments, to basically keep people dumb, to not explain to them how these things work. And so that there was no possibility for wider society to build alternatives alongside it. That knowledge of how to build these things remained incredibly siloed. And again, capturable by power. You know, that leads not just to the centralization of power. It leads quite directly to the kind of collapse of, ultimately democracy, but that implies that democratic power was never really that strong. But like the collapse and the possibility of that kind of democracy, because, you know, there was this dream of the decentralization of networks, creating a decentralization of power and therefore a more empowered citizenry, a power held in common rather than centralized in governance or large corporations. Alongside that was this decentralization of information. And that also had this kind of incredibly utopian ideal associated with it, which was that if we all could find out and learn anything at the press of a button, we'd all magically become empowered. You know, that there was this relationship between information and power that also mattered, and that somehow, through some extraordinary alchemy, the availability of information would empower us all, and we'd again come into some kind of great sunny uplands of a human future. And again, once again, because of the lack of education that accompanied that, the lack of kind of any real education people get in kind of critical thinking, thoughtfulness, the ability to parse information, because raw information itself is just useless, and often worse than useless, actively dangerous. We find ourselves in the current situation of a kind of global society ruptured by fundamentalisms, kind of characterized by fear and anger. The idea that we would all, you know, through access to information, converge
together
to like one single point, the opposite has happened.
Exactly.
You know, the triumph of kind of conspiracy theory, of kind of fundamentalist beliefs, of this kind of real schisms and fractures within society, that's the product of what happens when you have massive amounts of information but no like concomitant education and thoughtfulness around it. So those are all the things that have happened with the internet and technology. Yeah, they're a combination of a kind of belief in technological determinism, that the technology alone would achieve this, and a kind of willful capture by corporation and failure of governance.
These corporations become very powerful. I mean, they have so much money, much more money than certain states in the world. Also don't really follow the laws of many countries or ethical standards or democratic standards. I mean, they just do what they think is best for them, and politics and our ethical commissions and everybody just are behind them. They just set things, and we need 5 or more years to cope with that and to understand, is this according to our ethical beliefs or democratic standards or whatever. So they have a huge power on humanity, on democracy, as you say, but on any kind of form of state. I'm not even talking about the abuse, about the interfering with elections and all this, but just the fact that they take your personal information and treat it in some way is basically not, from the beginning, not according to German law, let's say. Then Germany or European Union will move, and then about some years they will make some legislation that they will try to confine these companies. How do you see this, the possibilities out of that? I mean, it's a huge power, and the power will always get bigger, it seems, because they continue this centralization. And, well, many of the questions I've written come together in this, because the point is also that AI or this machine learning, these systems, or these big cloud systems need huge amounts of money, of know-how, of, well, knowledge of machines, of computers, of resources. Is there really a chance that that can be democratized, so to say? Do you think? Because, I mean, building an AI means you have to invest huge amounts of money, manpower, thoughts, resources, machines. Can this ever be democratized? Or will it always be, by definition, property of huge corporations?
The examples that you're describing can never be democratized because they are properties of an undemocratic system. Mm. Like, they just don't work. It's really striking that, you know, I studied AI 20 years ago, like academically, at the end of the kind of last wave of interest in AI, because the history of AI is what get called like the AI summers and winters. There's these kind of flowerings of research and like a bunch of discoveries happen. Everyone gets very excited about some new way of making intelligence happen. And then it doesn't work very well and kind of fades into obscurity for a decade. And then it comes back. And at the end of the last wave, everyone was very excited about these things called neural networks, which is based on like a particular set of mathematical discoveries that could do some really interesting things. But they were very small scale. They exhibited all these interesting properties, but there wasn't a lot, it seemed, you could do with them. No one, you know. And so, like, AI kind of fell from academic and public consciousness to a large extent for a few years. What happened in the meantime was that the internet developed, and these large technology corporations developed, and they had access to two very important things, which they had access to processing power, and they had access to vast amounts of data. And these were, you know, and money is wrapped up in all of that, because by sitting astride the network and extracting data in this way, you make money out of it in a classic kind of extractivist way. So what's important was note about the current wave of AI, because it will be another wave, and that will go and that will come back again, is that this current wave involves no new discoveries. It's the application of a quite old. I mean, there's been some interesting optimizations of neural networks, and they've figured out some new ways of doing them, but the fundamental discovery hasn't changed. It's just had this huge injection of cache, data, and processing power, or rather data and processing power as a result of all this cache being available. And so it is only possible to build this particular version of AI, which is a very particular version, if you have these vast cash reserves, which you can only have if you've been exploiting your power for a decade or so, right? Nothing good. There's no way to get that rich in a good way. So they are tainted in this way. And, you know, as I've written, they are a particular form of AI that comes out of doing it that way. It's Huxley's means, not ends. But the means are, you know, the ends are bad, the means are bad in this case. These are designed by profit-seeking corporations to maximize their profits. And so, of course, that the AI that they make is a profit-maximizing AI. And so it embodies all of that, you know, extractivist, capitalist desire. Like how you can't democratize that. There's nothing democracy wants from that at all. So it's optimizing for completely the wrong things for us. We can have a whole different conversation about, you know, what democratic possibilities AI might have. But the ones that we're seeing at the moment are completely not that. And this thing about kind of extraction and how they got all that data and power, I think, is really interesting, because it's very striking to me. The best kind of theorist of this is Shoshana Zuboff, whose book kind of Surveillance Capitalism really, really, really lays out in quite excellent insider detail how, and for, you know, she's pretty clear for American neoliberal academic on like primitive accumulation and the way in which these corporations basically understood that the contents of our heads and our most secret desires were a material that could be extracted and turned into profit, and they set about doing that. And it's very clear, and she explains it very, very well. And then she says, but of course that's bad capitalism, you know, we shouldn't have done that, but if we just tweak it a bit, we could have good capitalism. And you can't separate those things. Like that is the capitalist process. It is an ongoing process of material extraction. And that's what's happened in the technological sphere, but this time it's kind of reached into our, you know, brainstems. And it will keep digging away and going deeper. And as we talked earlier, these are very powerful tools for doing that. So it's so sad because it also just like really limits our imagination and expectation of what these things could be. And when the entire public discourse turns on this trash, you know, these stupid large language models and this reduction of intelligence to winning and, of beinghood to being in a box, to being this type of machine. It's so pathetic, and it captures people's imagination and makes it impossible to think about, or very hard to think about other things. And it also leads to, you know, really quite weird beliefs, because within the within the kind of capitalist worldview, which most people, when challenged, won't always explicitly endorse, what you have is you have a technological class, i.e. the people who are building this thing, who they're very happy to get the money out of it, but they're not gauche enough to talk about how rich they're getting out of it. What they will talk about is how this is something almost spiritual. And, I've spoken to a lot of very senior people who work within this world who have this belief in a kind of computational universe, who believe that the universe is at heart a mechanism, a binary, not necessarily binary, but something resembling a binary computer. You know, it is a computational mechanism, a kind of information processor. And the AI is like learning the language of God that will allow us to kind of speak to it. And it's to me, it's this kind of barren and terrifying vision. But it's being promulgated by the success of these tools. And it really, it has very, very deep impact on society at large, far, far beyond the impact of like the actual AI tools. Because the AI tools are really, as I say, they're pretty crappy. But they, through their existence and through the way they're talked about and discussed and just all the air they take up in the room, they really contribute to a very narrow, sad and cold kind of view of the universe at large, I feel, which is bad.
It's leveling everything, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of stands outside any of those kind of particular judgments, really. Mm. But I think one of the things it is quite like is what you described earlier of this. It has no concept of meaning as being relational.
Yeah.
You know, it absorbed all of these texts
and
completely flatly and just, you know, repeats the patterns within them as though they are the meaning rather than the relationships that those patterns make possible.
Mm. And people are enthusiastic about it because they think there is a meaning. They are tricked into the thought that there is a meaning in the text they give back or something.
Yeah, meaning and truth and a bunch of other things. Mm. And just a kind of glamour, you know.
Mm.
A glamour in like the full magical sense
of
something that has this kind of aura that, you know, we've been told to think is important.
They can take university tests now and all these things. Mm. And why would you say, from a technical or from your point of view, they are crap, really? Because you're repeating this.
Because they're not... They're not producing or doing anything. Like, there's no... I want to clarify this. There's some real... There are some things that are doing, I think, probably really interesting things that I don't really understand very well. So the application of this to, like, protein folding, right? It's like medical discovery. I think there's probably some really amazing stuff going on there. That's one of the few good uses I can think of. Because also, like, as I've written about, like, AI is very, very powerful and very, very useful at oil and gas extraction. But I don't want that to happen. Mm. So, like, it's very good at a lot of things that I don't think should happen. It's rubbish at a lot of the things, all of the stuff around meaning and creativity that gives it the glamour. That's I think what's really striking is like the reason, you know, we don't think very clearly about the role, the things that it's actually doing, is because we get stuck around all these things like ChatGPT, which are just not interesting, and they're not doing the thing, or the image generation as well, which is terrible. Not only does it just like make meaningless work that has no, that looks like, you know,
looks like aesthetic, but
if I say anything, I end up being rude about people who work hard to make these things. So I went, it's based on all of this extraction, you know, which is damaging in all these kind of ways. It is possible, I believe, I'm led to understand, to do other things of very specific types of problem. But also, you know, critically, this is where it might become interesting again. It's good at doing things that humans aren't good at doing. Like, it's the grand tragedy of this, that we're obsessed with AI doing things like we do them. This thing I said before about, like, us defining intelligence as being, like, human intelligence. Like, we're really bad at folding proteins in our heads because it's an incredibly complex thing. That's why we have computers to do it, right? And AI is very, very good at doing things that computers are good at because it's a computer, right? Like, it has a computational intelligence. It interacts with the world and it's
intelligence embodies this completely different experience of the world.
And it can handle masses of information.
And it can handle vast amounts of information in ways that humans simply can't. So, you know, so it's really good also at things like, you know, playing a game like Go, which is, you know, which is an information search problem at scale. But to reduce it to an information search problem is to miss out on what actually makes it interesting in the first place. Just as to think that, you know, illustration is about making a realistic picture is to miss out on what actually is going on here. And that's fine. It doesn't mean that, like, computers are bad or AI is universally dumb. It just means that it's just like, it's another way of being in the world that we can relate to in certain ways. And that, you know, we can cooperate with in certain ways. And, you know, but equally will be used for all sorts of terrible things as well. And as, you know, as I always said, the most interesting thing about AI is not really anything that it's done so far, but simply what it is, which is a non-human intelligence. Because that is fundamental. That is a new Copernican moment, which could be foundational for a revolution in consciousness. Because it is the undeniable, I don't want to say proof, because that grounds it in a kind of scientific understanding, but just the undeniability of non-human intelligence being real and existing in the world. And as soon as you make that acknowledgement, so much else becomes possible. And yeah, again, it always leads you into this weird state of being both, like, you know, I'm quite insistent on my denial of AI being like a thing or real or these things, and at the same time going, but it's also the most revolutionary thing that can possibly happen.
Manifestation of something important.
You know? And it's in this weird state at the moment, kind of hanging somewhere between like thought experiment and reality. But again, that's where I like to hold things. It's like I said earlier about video calling. Like, science fiction video calling is an act of the imagination, is really interesting. Actually existing video calling is incredibly dull, but it's a thing to think with. Right, and AI is kind of one of the ultimate things to think with, I think, the humans have come up with.
It's the thought which is nice, maybe not the how it's realized in this moment or in this period of life, but the idea of it is fantastic.
Well, what should we? Yeah. What can we do with that idea?
Monte Verità, borderlines,
inequalities of power and profit will be becoming bigger and bigger. Are there ways out of this trap? Because we are seeing that there is this happening, but do you see ways out of this trap besides of switching off the computer and going to watch the sea?
But I mean, any technological problem at sufficient scale is a political problem. Like, this is not going to be solved through technology. It's not going to be solved. It's going to be solved through like governance and politics. And at the moment, most countries seem to keep electing governments that like the profits and the patronage of these companies. They are products, these companies are products of our political systems as much as they are products of, you know, any particular technological invention. Google and Facebook are the two largest lobbying organizations in Washington, D.C. They outspend anyone else in order to influence politicians. So they only exist in the forms that they do because of the political structure and freedoms they're allowed. And all of this stuff about, you know, oh, it's impossible to regulate technology, it moves too fast, is rubbish. I'm no fan of national governments in general, or the EU in particular, or any of these other things. But it's perfectly possible to regulate these things. There's just no or very little political will to do so. Like, so the problem has nothing to do with these companies, it has nothing to do with technology, and, you know, everything. If we can't regulate, like, the financial markets, you know, which are a far bigger driver of inequality than the technology companies, to be very clear, then we don't stand a chance of making any of those kind of changes. There are other political systems available. And also, particularly, I think, There are ways to that change through changing the way we do governance processes. So
like I don't. We're never going to change it by voting in a different party. Like we'll do it by changing the very processes by which we do politics. It's why I'm super interested in, you know, things like citizens' assemblies, governed processes like Saltitian, that actually get to the heart of how we as communities make decisions. And of course, in much bigger experiments in actual kind of anarchist autonomy and such things. Like, those are really, unfortunately, the only answer to the question. There's not anything any politician in power right now is going to do about it.
No. And there's also no technology which will save us from technology, let's say. There's no real chance of building up a different internet or a different network for us. There are these kind of small moves like Mastodon going,
So what's interesting about those is not that they will magically save us. Mm. I've spent the last decade and more telling people that they need to understand how computers work better and teaching people basic HTML, basic bits of programming, opening up little computers, showing people the inside of them and making artworks and installations that kind of demonstrate these in various ways. And the point of doing that, and this comes back to the conversation about education earlier, has always been not to, I'm not a politician saying everyone needs to learn to code because they should get a job in this and this is the future of the economy right now. So you need to learn to code because you need to understand the structures of the world around you. Because these are a set of tools that you interact with every day, whether you're aware of them or not. And if you're not aware of them, they have power over you. They have excessive power over you. Your life is in large determined by the operation of these mechanics that you have no access to. And that has a material cost. You lack, the possibility of fulfilling your potential in interacting with these mechanisms. It also has a deep spiritual cost in that people feel it. Even if they don't phrase it in the way that I'm phrasing it, right? People are aware that they don't understand how everything around them works.
And what would you say is the spiritual cost?
This is the spiritual cost, that people feel that they don't understand everything around them.
They get
ignorance, depression, rage, and fear. Mm-hmm. This is the dominant tenor of the age. Mm-hmm. And for me, it is intimately connected with the fact that we live in a world of complex systems that few of us have any access to. And the result of that is that we feel we have no control over our own lives. And we feel we have no say in what happens to us. And we feel we have no way of shaping our own futures. And the term that some psychologists use for that, and I usually use for it, is agency. Is the agency is the feeling that you have some control over your own life, that you know where you stand and that you can shape your own future. Mm-hmm. And that is what is removed by most of our technologies, mm-hmm. and also by most of our systems of governance. Mm-hmm. And the result is this deep trauma and the kind of repetition of that trauma, because we can't act, we can't change. And so for me, one of the really fundamental processes that has to happen inside that system is the restoration of agency. And that's what the teaching people to code bits is about. But it's also been, and I've always insisted that it's not about because you should be a programmer. It's because you need to have some systemic understanding of the world around
language you. And
yeah, mm-hmm. mental models.
Exactly.
Mental models being really key. And what I've learned in the last few years as well that's super interesting is you can do it with pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. I over the last few years I've got more into kind of renewable technologies and trying to, just firstly for my own interest and subsequently for work. I wanted to know how to wire up solar panels. I wanted to know how wind turbines work. I wanted to... on one level, it's getting bigger because you're working with, bigger mechanisms. On the other hand, it's actually getting smaller because you're getting down into, the electrons. And you have to, get really into, microelectronics, which is below the level of code. So it's kind of these different levels. But it turns out that learning and teaching that stuff is the same as learning to teach in code. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. What you're doing is you're increasing agency, which is people's feeling that they can act on the world around them in their own interest. Mm-hmm. And it's such a powerful thing. And it is the thing that is mostly lacking mm-hmm. in most people. And it is really, for me, it's half of the problem. The other half is power that doesn't care whether you've got agency or not and is trying to screw you over.
Just
all the
want
time.
You.
But the other half is agency, and it's a thing that can be worked, and when you start to see things through the lens of agency, it does provide a path in a lot of possibilities, which is. To bring it back to this political question I mentioned earlier, things like systems assemblies and sortition, those are structures within governance systems for restoring agency to people. They're systems that not only engage people in forms of direct democracy or kind of other forms of engagement, but also involve active processes of learning and education and empowerment, that people go into those processes and they come out of them with greater agency. Mm-hmm. And so once again, the end result is not necessary to make everyone into a politician, but those things seem to go hand in hand to some degree.
Involve people in processes. And
yeah. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you're just always stood outside the world.
Of course.
And mm-hmm. And that means you have no power, but it also means that you're, if you even stop to think about it for a moment, you're like deeply psychically troubled, and then you start doing violence and damage elsewhere as well.
This is the first part of episode 1, Monteverità Borderlines. Marcus Zona meets James Bridle. The second part is now available. Monteverità Borderlines has been commissioned by Eventi Letterari Monteverità and produced by Marcus Zona Arts Company. Interview with Mr. James Bridle, Marcus Zona. Editorial staff and writing, Patrizia Barbuiani, Luca Mastaroli, Elisabetta Prete, Marcus Zona. Sound technician, Patrick Botticchio. Photography and video, Primitive Films. Editing, Luca Mastaroli, Marcus Zona at Studio Radio Petrushka. Sound engineer and mixing, Andrea Cosentino at Unorthodox Sound Studio. Music, Valpak. This episode was recorded in Greece in February 2023 and published on March the 30th, 2023. Copyright Eventi Letterari Monteverità and Marcus Zona, 2023.